First of all, it's a very muggy evening in the West End of London this evening. We're expecting a mix of clear blue skies, which are at the moment, and then torrential downpours. And maybe that's a sign of something, I don't know. But, I mean, on College Green, and we're used to this scene on big political days, and today is no different. There's a whole run, 11 or so, of white tents here with the world's media stacked up, all delivering the news, both of what's already happened today, that we have the 56th Prime Minister of the United Kingdom appointed, but the news that is to come. This is the cabinet announcements, and we'll explore that in due course, because we're not sure on the time scale of that. As you said, I mean, this seems to be shifting around, you know, minute by minute, hour by hour here. But yeah, so anticipation is here, but there are lots of big names around here. You'd notice all the people from the international television and radio. John Sobel and Emily Maitlis are walking around here. Some senior MPs as well. Some of our own MPs, we've been speaking to a few of them. We're going to be joined by more of them here on College Green in the next 2 hours as well. And there's lots to talk about, not just what does Liz Truss mean for Northern Ireland, but what could a new Secretary of State mean for Northern Ireland? And there is a name circulating above all others this evening, so we will bring that to you shortly.
He lost his job at PSG, and now he's lost his job at Chelsea, but, you know, there'll be other jobs, people queuing up to take him for sure.
How many times have you lost your job, Harry?
Offhand, that's difficult. I'm trying to figure it out now. I never lost my job at Portsmouth twice. I left there. I never lost my job at Southampton. Did lose my job at Bournemouth. I lost my job at West Ham. And I lost my job at Birmingham. They were the only two clubs, yeah.
Do the scars remain, though? Do you have any ill will? Because it must feel personal, doesn't it?
Oh, you take it personal, yeah. You're upset you've not been able to bring success to the club. But sometimes you go to a club and you see the people you're dealing with, the people that are making decisions, and you realise it's a very tough job. You know, you're sometimes dealing with people who haven't got a clue about football, and you're relying on them. They've got opinions about what you should be doing, who you should be signing or whatever. And, you know, it's an impossible job, honestly. It would be like you being on the radio speaking today, and someone who's never done it in their life comes out from working in a shop somewhere or whatever they do, starting telling you how you should be conducting your job. And that's the way
it is. Exactly what you're talking about, Harry.
We get plenty of people texting us.
You talked there about the priority being high impact video content. What does that mean?
Well, it means great stuff on iPlayer.
That's everything from EastEnders to a great documentary. Okay.
Yeah.
And you say that the BBC has to look and feel competitive in that realm. People might argue that actually that is a realm that the commercial sector can look after quite capably on their own. But what the BBC is uniquely positioned to do is provide local content on a micro scale to distinct audiences across the UK. And it appears that there is a direction of travel away from that, that actually we are going for the glossy, big audience fixtures in the schedule, and it's programmes like Foyle Breakfast that are being dispensed with. What would you say to that?
Well, I don't accept the premise of the question. I don't think it's...
Why not? What part?
Because I don't think it's an either or. I think it's an...
Well, it clearly is today.
No, it's not. Let me return to the reasons behind the announcement in Radio Foyle. So we spend about a fifth of our overall Radio Ulster budget on Foyle, but Foyle has a tenth of the Radio Ulster available audience. Foyle has a kind of catchment area, which is the third smallest in the BBC after Jersey and Guernsey. So we have to make some pretty practical and difficult decisions about whether the amount of money that we're putting into Foyle will release the greatest amount of audience value.
Is that not making my point for
you? No, it's not making your point for you, because I still believe that it is possible to do both. What I'm saying is that we are reallocating funding, but we are not abandoning Foyle. And I think if there's a narrative that has been created that we're abandoning Foyle, I disagree with that narrative. And I would say that's not true.
Call me which said you're closing it by stealth.
Well, we're not.
For those who would point to the judgment of BBC management in Northern Ireland and the decisions that have been made and are made, they may point to the example of a programme that you're keeping, Sean Coyle, the highest performing on Sounds. And that was a programme that survived, some would say, by the skin of its teeth. It was going to be dispensed with, and yet it has turned out in the wash to be a kind of one of the jewels in the foil crown. Would you accept that as a criticism that, you know, mistakes have been made previously in judgment?
We're human beings. We make mistakes.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether that's a news helicopter or a Metropolitan Police helicopter, but it's one of them. So that's a good indicator that the Prime Minister is close. Welcome to College Green. We are right outside the Houses of Parliament and just less than half a mile away, really. Liz Truss is due to arrive. We're going to spend the time waiting for the Prime Minister. Speaking to your former Cabinet Secretary, or a member of the Cabinet, Anne Widdecombe, how long were you? You were 20-odd years in the Commons, sir.
I was 23 years in the Commons, yes. Yeah, 7 of them in office under John Major, 3 in opposition under William Hague, and the rest of the time, obviously, on the backbenches.
Do you wish you were in the throes of it now? With
dear
the...
God, I thank him every day that I am not there.
Why so?
Well, I can't imagine any lunatic wanting to be there now. I mean, first of all, the challenges.
Guidance from the Department of Education has said schools should be keeping costs of PE clothing to a minimum. They say the boards of governors should give a high priority to cost considerations when designing their uniforms. Now, if you were listening to this station this morning, Cooley Yusuma, the Children's Commissioner, was talking to the guys on Good Morning Ulster about concerns that parents have of covering the costs. Cooley joined us again this evening because this story has moved somewhat.
It really has.
Based on these figures, which we think this is the first time we've gotten any sense of a picture of the commercial deals between schools and sportswear retailers. Generally speaking, what's your sense? What's your reaction? What stands out for you?
Declan, I'm actually almost speechless, but I will soldier through. I am really shocked. I find this really quite shocking because we have been talking, not just today, not just this week, but for years about the affordability of school uniforms, but particularly about the need to move away from branded PE kits, as particularly for children who don't represent the school. So we have talked a lot, and I have chosen to believe that schools are not making money. It's not an income stream for schools. Now, let's be clear, schools are underfunded, incredibly and chronically underfunded. But as parents and thousands of parents, and we know that there are between 92 and 95,000 children on uniform grants, as they struggle to buy uniforms and PE kits for their children, I cannot believe what your FOI has revealed, and I'm finding it really difficult to understand how this is only coming to light now, and schools are not stepping up to the plate.
Let's talk about, and this wasn't widely reported by the schools that got back to us, but on occasions staff had been getting free kits every year when parents had been forking out for the student sportswear.
And some of the conversations that have been.
As we watch the images from Windsor Great Park and the long walk up to the castle, the sound that you're hearing belies the number of people who are standing there. There are tens of thousands of people, it looks like to me, at a rough guess, lining this long walk up. But just have a listen to the silence in Windsor as the state hearse passes. Meanwhile, gathering in St. George's Chapel are those, Gavin, this is going to be a smaller service here. We see Sir Tony Blair and Cherie Blair arriving, but this will be much more intimate, I say that.
Yes, it will, Declan. This service is the committal service, so it's not going to be the full glare of the public office. This will be a smaller blending of a family affair as well as the civic duties.
will be joined in the Distinguished Visitors Gallery, along with the likes of Gerry Adams, Colm Eastwood, the leader of the SDLP, the Alliance leader, Naomi Campbell, and the leader of Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland.
Naomi Campbell? That's very exciting.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. That would be a story, wouldn't it? Naomi Long.
Ah, yes. Tell us this, because we appreciate that you are talking and moving. Just paint us a picture. Where are you being holed up now? Where's the press being kind of thrown into, penned into?
Yeah. Well, I've just got off the bus. You've probably heard from the acoustics outside. Now I'm back inside in Dublin Castle, where the media are based, the international media. It's a big conference room in what's called the Printworks.
But of course, people are just thinking about the best accommodations, particularly for families with kids.
How do you teach a 10-year-old to be brave?
I always tell him that mom and dad will do everything possible to keep him safe. And that if we follow all the rules, he should be fine. And also that he is Ukrainian and we have to be strong and fight back, and together we can win. And also he knows some people who are fighting, including my boyfriend, who is not his dad, a bit of a family story. And he knows that he is fighting, so he always asks about him and if he's all right, and he worries about him. But I tell him that, you know, that Sasha is fighting there at war to protect all of us.
That's where it needs to be at, so that women are protected, you know, to be treated equal, in the sense that we are supported when we're going through this journey. Just to allow us to come back into those spaces and perform our duties to the best that we can at that particular moment in our lives.
And apart from the emotional upset, the anxiety, the level of distraction, are you experiencing during this process any physical effects? I'm mindful, I was speaking in the last 24 hours to a woman who was explaining she's menopausal, and she was saying, I've got total brain fog. And I have to admit to you, Deborah, I don't think I associated brain fog with the menopause, but I appreciated being told. And I just wonder if you're listening to anyone, or you know, if you're working with anyone who's going through the IVF process, what would you like their colleagues to appreciate?
You know, absolutely. You know, when you think about a cycle of fertility, quite often women are put into a pseudo-menopause. So similarly to any other woman going through a full menopause, they are experiencing very similar symptoms.
This one says, Evening Extra, it's no wonder more and more people from government, political parties, etc. refuse to speak to BBC News. Yous couldn't wait to 5 p.m. to break the news. You broke an agreement. Doesn't matter if you don't understand or don't agree with the embargo. Ours is not to reason why. You just spoil everything. For all you know, Secretary of State may have been hoping for a last-minute change. It's fair enough to allow more time. Shame on you, BBC. We're going to address that. For those just joining us, there was an embargo placed on this announcement.
Until 5 o'clock,
even though the announcement was made in the street to journalists with passers-by at 3:30. We asked the Northern Ireland office to explain what reason they wanted us to sit on this news for around 90 minutes or so. And they couldn't provide us with a reason. The BBC and the editors here don't take these decisions lightly to break embargoes. There's a huge public interest in whether an election or not is being called. So to say that we broke an agreement and ours is not to reason why, in fact, we would argue ours is to reason why. That's why we're here. If it is not acceptable for you to have not been told, do you think this is a knock-on effect of not taking your place at the executive?
Well, no, I don't quite see how you come to that.
Were the executive up and running, do you think someone at the business department would have called you?
No, because I'm still a minister and I'm still in post. And I think it's worth raising, actually, Declan, asking you what you meant whenever you said at the top of the programme that without a sitting assembly instalment, energy support has been trickier and has led to delays. That's not the case. The issues that we're facing are not as a result of who delivers this in terms of the government departments, but other issues that we're facing around the nature of our energy market. But I'm meeting
it
Minister.
Has been well acknowledged. I mean, I'll respond to your point. It has been well acknowledged that the rollout of help to to bill payers in Northern Ireland has been hampered by a lack of sitting executive. And I know you are in a caretaker position, but you can't take new decisions. You are in a caretaker role.
Declan, I have to say, that is just nonsense. Right. Like, acknowledged by who? By Sinn Féin and the Alliance Party, who are making political points here. In fact, if this were to go through the Northern Ireland Executive and to go through the Assembly, it would actually take longer. You're just spouting the Sinn Féin and the Alliance Party political line. It doesn't bear any resemblance.
Why do we need a working group then to get it up and running?
We were looking at the best mechanism, the best way in which this support could be delivered. It wasn't about who would deliver it. It was always right that a UK government scheme was announced and that the UK government delivered it. We didn't deliver furlough in Northern Ireland. We didn't deliver any of those high-level supports that were announced by the UK government. So it's quite frankly absurd to say that this has been delayed in any way by the absence of an executive. Having to go through a Northern Ireland executive would actually have delayed things. And I've been speaking to other UK government ministers in my role as a minister here in Northern Ireland. I don't think it makes any substantive a difference in this way. And I think we just need to kneel that lie that other people have been telling, that in some way things would all be rosy if we had an executive.
I think what people are suggesting is that if we had a sitting executive, we may know where the £400 energy bill support payment was coming from, how it was going to get here.
And I've been on your programme before.
You see, what started as British customs points had soon become targets for Republicans because they symbolised the division of Ireland. As a tax increased, so too did levels of protection, until incrementally, customs posts evolved into full army-run checkpoints.
Police and army fortified checkpoints, a sitting target for IRA attacks.
They had watchtowers, high fences, cameras, guns trained on approaching vehicles, searchlights, document checks. You know, back, so this is pre-1998, I remember my dad's registration number, and I remember it in a kind of a South of England accent. It was an orange, I think it was a Vauxhall or something, I don't even know the type of car, but the reg was 8373 Indian Hotel, because it was always an English accent that would read it out. So as we were crossing the border, You'd hear 8373 as they were checking the reg of the car. The Good Friday Agreement, though, on the assumption that peace was going to follow, reads like this.
The British government will make progress towards the objective of as early a return as possible to normal security.
There's a sense that this has been pinned down. I don't know if you can hear that rain.
I can hear that. We're all smiling here in the studio.
Listen, here, I got to tell you, we have managed to nab ourselves a tent because not all the broadcasters who paid for tents have turned up to tents.
Just don't tell our colleagues in Bloomberg.
Just don't tell our colleagues in Bloomberg. Well, Bloomberg haven't felt that they should show up, but my God, are we glad that Bloomberg haven't turned up here today.
I think they may be operating on a different time zone, and I think we perhaps have cashed in on that today.
I mean, Richard, if it's raining this heavily here, you can see the screens. They must be being soaked up on Downing Street.
Yeah, Downing Street is a sea of umbrellas now. The journalists, the camera crews, the photographers, MPs huddling under umbrellas, sharing umbrellas. The lectern outside Downing Street, a black bin liner had been placed over it. That was then taken away, but it has now been placed over the lectern, the podium, once again, because, you can hear why. You can hear why. Plenty of people with very wet suits. So I'm not sure this is going to happen outside because, the podium has just been taken away. It's been removed. Yeah. So
I mean, the rain here is bouncing off the footpath. Yeah, no, the rain here is bouncing off the footpath. But as Barry said, this could be a shower. And look, everyone's going to wait to hear what the new Prime Minister has to say anyway, even if it does only last 3 minutes. And you were saying this will be purposely broad brushstrokes. You know, we're not going to get any major revelations in the rain, are we?
We're not waiting in tender hooks to get the detail of some sort of energy saving scheme she's going to announce on Thursday. But I do know that contingency plans have already been scoped out, if you like, for an indoor speech by Liz Truss, and that is what we might get, Declan, if this weather keeps up, because I can't see her stepping out of the car into a torrential downpour to try and deliver a speech, albeit just 3 minutes she will have to stand there.
And
so
actually,
I would imagine we might be falling back to plan B.
The rain is so heavy that the helicopter following the motorcade, it is now almost difficult to see the vehicles and moving through Central London.
We know London. Richard. You know, we know. I mean, we're in it, Richard. But thanks for your description there. Well, look, how heavy the rain is.